Well, welcome to our second Lunch and Learn of the year. And as we always do, we're going to begin today with having Reverend Ralph bless our food.
And always I bless the food, whatever condition it may be in currently. Let's join in prayer. Gracious Lord, we thank you for this beautiful day. We thank you for this time that we can be gathered together in this fellowship and place. We are so thankful for the many blessings that you continue to shower upon us. May they be the love that binds us to each other and to you. Bless now this food, the hands prepared it, and the time of sharing it with one another. For all these gifts, we give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen.
Well, we have our cousin Katie back with us. It's her third time here. And so when we wanted to do this session on estate planning, there was only one person that we knew could do it in a friendly way and be welcomed, and thank you. So, officially, Kristen K. Woods, or Katie, as she is known by her friends and family, is a native of St. George and a graduate of Dixie High School. Katie is a lawyer specializing in end-of-life planning, not today, no, and care, and is the immediate past president of the Utah State Bar Association. Congratulations. Katie provides legal services such as estate planning, probate, and guardianship expertise to clients through her law office and is also the founder and manager of OWL Guardianship and Elder Care Services, LLC, which provides care management and fiduciary services to over 150 disabled adults across the state of Utah. In her spare time, Katie enjoys spending time with her beautiful wife, Kaylee, and their four dogs, attending Utah jazz games, being outside working in her yard, and traveling. And she's one of those crazy people. I didn't write this. She's one of those crazy people who likes to take several ice baths a week and most recently took one in a lake in wintry Finland. Good. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you so much. All right, I'll turn this on, and then do you want me? Okay, we're switching.
Yep.
Okay. If at any time someone can't hear me, please let me know. But thank you so much for having me back. I felt so comfortable with you guys. I was casual today, so I kept my hat on for you. So thanks for having me. I love speaking here. I've had several clients that I've made and relationships that I've made with people from your congregation, and it's been a real pleasure. I'm going to just take a few minutes as I'm introducing myself a little bit more to kind of give you guys a handout that's going to be handy for what I'm going to talk about and maybe something that you guys can take home and use as you're thinking about your own situations and organization in your estates and things like that. As I understand it, I think this is kind of a preparedness kind of series that you guys are doing. Is that right? Or just... Okay. Okay. Got you. Great. So what I tell people is, you know, when it comes to estate planning and this sort of thing, it's kind of the last thing that we all want to take time out and think about, because, you know, it's not a fun thing to think about the end of our lives, right? But what I tell people is, if you can think about it in a different way, where you're not planning for what happens after you die, but you're planning for what is happening while you're still alive, the peace that you're going to feel when you're organized, how you've got this structured, depending on how your own family is, depending on relationships within your own family, and thinking about what you can do to organize things in a way that are going to bring as peaceful a process to your heirs and to your family after you pass. But also, I'm going to hit on today something that I actually think is the most important part of your estate plan, which is the healthcare directive, and this is a form that is valid only while you're alive. So You know, when we talk about estate planning, the first things that come to mind are wills, trusts, right? The thing about wills and trusts are they don't make a lot of difference for you personally while we're still alive. It helps us feel peaceful about our organization and how we, you know, have set things up to transfer. But they really don't take effect until we've passed away. So we're off to our next great adventure, and, you know, everyone else left here has to work things out. But this healthcare directive is a very important form, so I'm going to start with this before we dive into the estate planning stuff, because this form is the way that you get to make certain selections about what you want to have happen to your health and your healthcare, including end-of-life decision-making when it comes to life support and that sort of thing. And you get to make a legal determination of that before you become incapacitated or have an accident or get dementia or Alzheimer's disease, you know, that gets so bad that you are no longer able to make these decisions. So I tell people, you know, as early as you can, fill this form out. And the best thing about this form is that it's absolutely free from the state of Utah. So you don't need a lawyer to help you do this. You just need to either just go online and print this out, or your doctor's office will have these forms at there as well. So this form they've made really easy for you to fill out because it doesn't even require a notary. It just requires a witness. So you can literally print this out at home, have your friend come over, watch you sign it, witness it, and you've got a valid healthcare directive. So I'm just going to spend a couple minutes talking about this directive and the decisions you're making in it. Tying into that is the handout that I've passed around. This is just a list of vocabulary, if you will. And these vocabulary terms are assignments that you give people, okay? So when you're thinking about doing your planning, you want to look at this list of assignments and decide and give some thought into who in your life you want to give these assignments to. The one that's relevant to your powers of attorney documents and your healthcare directive is the second one down, which is called your attorney in fact. Okay? Another way that people refer to that person is agent, and I've put that on the paper for you there. They're interchangeable. Okay? So when you elect an agent or an attorney in fact, that is the person that you are giving specific authority to do something for you while you're still alive, okay? So that's why I hand out this vocabulary sheet, because estate planning is 99% vocabulary, because when we're talking about wills, we have a whole list of terms that relate to a will. We have a whole list of terms that relate to a trust. We have a whole list of terms that relate to powers of attorney and healthcare directives. And so it can get really confusing. And so, you know, a lot of times when people come and talk to me, they might be confused about what they actually have done, because they might be talking to me about a trustee, but there's no trust. There's a will. A trustee doesn't go with a will. A trustee goes with a trust. And so sometimes it's good to talk to an attorney or, you know, come in and talk to me about what you've got, just to make sure that you've got what you think that you have, because it can just get really confusing. So your agent in this document can be anybody that you want it to be. It doesn't have to be your spouse. It doesn't have to be a child of yours. It can be a friend. It can be a trusted professional. But you can name anybody that you want to be the person to step in and make medical decisions for you in the case that you no longer can do that for yourself. So as long as you still have decision-making ability, even if you have dementia, right? There's varying levels of how severe a dementia can be or another cognitive issue. So as long as you're making, in your doctor's estimation, well-informed, reasonable decisions, then you're going to be in charge of your own care. It's once you lose that ability to do that, that your agent is now the person that steps in under Utah law. This is a Utah state form. Steps in and is able to talk to your doctors, get access to medical records, make plans with doctors as to your care and your treatment, consent to surgery, consent to medications, right? So you can see how this could be a very important thing for you to consider, because when we're talking about that sort of thing, we're talking about philosophy and your philosophies about life, end of life, treatment, right? Medication, organ donation. All of these things become a very personal thing to each of us. We have different opinions, different beliefs about end of life, and you want to make sure that your agent, even if they don't correspond with your beliefs, that they at least understand and respect yours, right? And so that's the first thing I would say is when you're considering who your agent is, make sure it's somebody that you trust. They could be, you know, somebody that maybe you don't agree with all the time, but if you feel that respect and love from them where you know that they're going to do what you want them to do, regardless of, you know, whether their politics are different from yours, then that's probably a pretty good decision. I would also encourage you to think about, when you're making an agent selection, consider having a conversation with that person. Don't just put them down. Maybe call them up on the phone or invite them out to lunch and say, this is kind of a bummer to talk about, but I want to talk to you about my philosophies about end of my life. I'm appointing you as agent, as you know, and this is what my beliefs are, because when we're doing planning, and this is the same for healthcare planning or for estate planning like wills and trusts, what I tell clients is we're always planning for worst case scenario and hoping for best, okay? So the hope is that we never have to use this. We never get in an end-of-life life support type of situation, that we're always able to make our own decisions. But we're planning for that worst-case scenario because, I mean, I just read a news story this morning about somebody in California who had space debris fall through their house into their floor, okay? So can you imagine if that hit that person in the house? You're just minding your own business and something falls from out, literally falls from outer space into your house, right? And your life completely changes at that point, right? So we live in a crazy world with some crazy things. And, you know, St. George has, we all know there's crazy drivers on the road in St. George, right? We all take our lives into our hands just driving around town. So, you know, the hope is that we don't need this, but reality is we should have this just in case, okay? So so I'm just going to point out a couple of things here. So the state of Utah wants you to make some certain yes or no determinations, including your philosophy about living in a care center, okay? Yes or no, is that something that you want your agent to admit you into a care center if you need that sort of thing? Also, organ donation is on there. There's a question about whether you want your agent to consent to your participation in medical research or clinical trials. So basically giving you the authority to decline experimental treatments if you don't care to let your agent have the power to consent to that. Okay, that's an important, interesting question, right? And then one of the most important things that I see in my line of work is nominating a guardian for yourself. So this, the term guardian is on your vocabulary sheet. A guardian, so Utah has two terms that relate to this, guardian and conservator, and both of those terms are on your sheet. A guardian and a conservator are people who are court appointed by a judge to step in and take over your decision-making, okay? So guardians and conservators are not always needed. They're mostly needed in situations where you have a long-term incapacity, where you're going to have someone making decisions for you for an extended period of time, not just an acute medical event, not just before a surgery, not, you know, but A good example of this is an Alzheimer's disease where it's going to progressively get worse over, you know, a long period of time. And the court is appointing someone and giving them an actual court order that they can take to banks, financial institutions, your retirement person, state of Utah, you know, you name it. That is an order that is all-powerful, even above health care directives and powers of attorney, okay? So that is a very powerful person. And so this form asks you, who do you want to be your guardian? Do you want it to be the same person you're nominating in your health care directive, or do you want it to be somebody else, okay? So that's worth some thought there, okay? And that's part of what I do through my agency, Owl Guardianship, is we find that there's a need in this community and across the state for folks that end up with these long-term incapacities that need a professional guardian because they don't have family members that are able to serve because they either, you know, don't have family members that are still surviving or their family members have gotten in some sort of trouble. They've, you know, exploited them in the past, right? There's a lot of financial exploitation out there. And so we get court appointed, myself and my guardians that I have on staff, to have a caseload of individuals that we serve in that capacity as guardian and conservator. So that's a very important thing to give some thought to. Then we flip to the page in this directive where we are most familiar with when we're talking about end of life. This is the life support decision, okay? Do you want to be on life support if you are reliant on it or not, okay? And again, this can have a lot of different layers to it, but basically the state of Utah gives you three choices. Your choices are one, I'm going to leave it completely up to my agent. Whatever, I trust this person, whatever this person thinks is best, they can decide for me. The second option is, my philosophy about end of life is that I wish to receive all the life support that I can until my body passes away. So keep me on the respirator, keep me on all the machines that are keeping me alive. I don't wish to be removed from those. The third choice is, from my experience, the most popular choice with my clients, which is, if the doctors say that I'm not going to be able to reasonably recover and survive without the assistance of the life support, please pull the plug, allow me to pass away. Okay, so that's an expression that you do not want to remain on life support if you're not, you know, after, you know, not right away, but after everybody's reasonably concluded there's no quality of life, you know, you'd rather be allowed to pass away than remain on the machinery. So you can see how that decision in particular really comes down to our own philosophies about death, the afterlife, religious beliefs, things of that nature. And it's been really interesting and a blessing in my life, honestly, to sit with people in this decision because we have a lot of, you know, a lot of conversations and a lot of emotional experiences about this decision. I once sat with a woman who had spent her life as a nun in the Catholic Church, and she had some strong religious beliefs surrounding this issue, and we made sure in her directive that we said according to the life support decision, before she was allowed to pass away, she wanted, you know, to have all the last rites of the Catholic Church performed by a priest, right? So this is a form where you can put and insert, and there are places in here where you can insert some of these instructions so that your agent is informed and can follow through with what your wishes are. So that is what I think is the most important part of your estate plan. Because, again, this affects us while we're here. We've lost control of our decision-making, but we're still here. And we don't want our bodies and our persons to be put through something that we don't consent to. And this is really the only way that you can control that. So if you have not already done this, I would encourage you, before you leave, come and take a picture of this or come write down the title of it, which is Utah Advance Healthcare Directive. So Utah Advance Healthcare Directive. And Google it. It'll pop right up. It's a free form from the state of Utah. Print it out, fill it out. And even if you never do a will or a trust, this is the best thing you can do, and it's free. So don't let lawyers charge you lots of money for that. You don't need that. A lot of times when we do estate planning, we do that as part of it, but you can easily do that on your own. It's very user-friendly. And I forgot to mention, if anyone has questions, comments, stories, please, I'm not somebody who wants to stand up here and talk for an hour at you. Raise your hand. Let's break up the presentation. I don't mind that at all. So please feel free to do that. Yeah. So the question was, do you need a will to avoid estate taxes, basically, right? Yeah, so the answer is there's really not, well, so let me start here. The good news is, for most of us, Congress has raised the bar of estate tax high enough that we fall under it. Now, if we're lucky to be over $5.5 million estate limit, then great. You are doing great, but you're going to have a little bit of tax, but that's fine, okay? Most of us are under that bar. So if your estate, so think about value of your real estate, which in St. George, real estate is valuable, right? So value of your real estate plus money in the bank, plus death benefits that are paying out, right? So that can add up. But if you're under $5.5 million with that number, when I started as an attorney 15 years ago, it was $1 million, which in St. George, a lot of times our houses are nearly that valuable. So that was a problem because a lot of us, in the middle class are getting these huge, estate tax is like 40% at this point. So 40% of your estate's going to the government. So Congress fixed that, raised it to $5.5 million. And so that's the first point is you probably don't, I actually hope you do have to worry about estate tax because you're just doing great. But if you're under that $5.5 million, doesn't matter if you don't have a will, doesn't matter if you have a will, doesn't matter if you have a trust and a will, you're fine. Does that make sense? Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
And so it put me in a bad spot, but I listened to the person and I talked to the doctors and it got all worked out that it was really difficult to use my life.
So sure.
Segue.
Yeah. So your point of, to your point, you can execute as many of these as you want. So if next year you go through a personal experience where your opinions on end of life changes, then by all means, do a new healthcare directive. By law, the latest in date is the one that's the legal one. But you do want to keep it updated if your agent changes. So, for a lot of us, depending on what phase of life we're in, if our agent is older than us, or the same age, we may get to a point because, hopefully we're all living to be like 130 years old and just very active and, fit and awesome and healthy. But we have to kind of make sure our agent is still healthy too, right? We don't, if Cousin Jeffrey's our agent and Cousin Jeffrey, develops some sort of a cognitive issue, we probably need to rethink Cousin Jeffrey as the agent, right? So that's kind of a changing thing. So to your point, yeah, just keeping up with your decisions, who your agent is, whether your personal philosophies have changed or you want to change things. The good news is, and the other thing is this, and this is a little bit harder to track and worth, you know, asking an attorney every once in a while, but every once in a while the state changes this form, which is not a big deal because they'll honor the old ones, but when they change it, they add things in. The good news is the state has not changed this since 2009, and I haven't heard any talk of this changing anytime soon. It's a pretty good form. But, you know, that's something that you can also keep track of. And then one last thing on this is if you spend time in different states and you're doing snowbird, you know, back and forth from somewhere, or you're just regularly hanging out in your condo in Miami, right? That'd be awesome. Make sure you've got the Florida documents done too, because these healthcare things, wills and trusts are pretty much universal. We get our law from Old England, right? Not much has changed with that sort of thing. But the healthcare stuff is very state specific. And we want doctors to be really familiar with the forms that they're looking at, because they're dealing with your something's happened where you can't talk to them. They're looking at a form. They're trying to make sure you're okay. Last thing we want is them to be trying to figure out legalities of things, right? So, yeah. So that's what I would suggest. Yeah. Sure. Sure. Yeah, like I said, wills and trusts, you're generally going to be fine. You know, one thing to check on wills and trusts, so in general, as long as your will and your trust are notarized and witnessed by two people, specifically the will being witnessed by two people, you're going to be fine everywhere. That's going to be a legal trust. The only time you really need to worry about changing wills and trusts is if you are changing who your trustee is. You know, who's the person that we're leaving in charge of our estate to divide it up and do all the business of the estate after we pass away. If you're changing that person, that's a big change. We need to change that in the document. Or how you're leaving things, you know. My son's, you know, really ticked me off. I'm taking him out of the will, right? You got to do that in writing and change that. Yeah. It depends on how it's written. So in general, a big life event like that, and I'm really sorry to hear that, a big life event like that is worth maybe a visit to an attorney or just sitting down and reading through the documents, because, you know, sometimes the will or the trust will have a built-in succession. So a lot of times the way that I'll write my trust for somebody is, you know, let's say the standard, I'm going to leave everything to my children equally. And we'll say, okay, so we've got two children equally, 50-50 to each of the two children. In the case that this one of my children predeceases me, I want that child's share to go through to my grandchildren, so their children. So sometimes they're written like that to provide for an heir that predeceases. If it's silent about that, then in general what the law says is that your son's estate now becomes the heir. So it's probably worth looking at that. Your son's estate is going to be whoever your son, if your son had an estate plan, whoever your son has given his estate to. So it comes back around to you. So we might have a little bit of an issue there with where that money ends up. And we want to avoid confusion about where the money ends up, because under Utah law, if there's money without destination, it goes to the state of Utah. So unless you want to make a great donation to the state of Utah, it might be worth, you know, looking at that at some point. So I always say, like, big life events, somebody passes away, we want to change the trustee, we want to change how we're distributing things, that's worth another visit to the lawyer's office to do that. Okay. What about probate, just kind of what it is and that sort of thing? Okay, yep, so probate, did I put that? Okay, that's a whole other can of worms, that's a whole other vocabulary sheet, but Okay, so probate is a scary, big scary word that we hear a lot about. It makes for great movies, books. You know, John Grisham has made a career out of writing about probates and how they go wrong and murders and all the things. But in reality, what probate is a process to unstuck assets. I just made that word up, unstuck. So let's think about it this way. So if I own a house, okay, so my house is located in Washington County, Utah. There's a deed recorded with the recorder's office that says Katie Woods owns this house located here, okay? That means, so when you buy a house, as you guys probably have experienced, you go through this whole title process where the title company is verifying the title, making sure there's no liens on the title. All they're doing is going to the recorder's office and tracing the history of the property to make sure that there's not some weird owner out there that, you know, is still has claim to the property, so that the person buying the property has a free and clear title. A guarantee from the title company that you are buying a house that is going to be 100% yours, and there's nothing that we can find on the title, and we guarantee it, and that's the title insurance stuff, you know. So if I own a piece of property, a piece of real estate free and clear, then I am the only person that can now sell that property. I have to be the one to sign the deed. I have to be the one to sign all the title documents to transfer it. Nobody else can do that unless I've given them authority through a power of attorney or something. So the problem arises when I die, okay? Because when I die, the recorder's office still shows that I own this property. So that property is now stuck. There's nobody except for me who could do anything to transfer this, and now I'm dead, okay? So that's a problem. So now what my heirs have to do is they have to go to probate. And all it is unsticking assets. So probates can happen with a will. They can happen without a will. But it's somebody simply going to court to say, Judge, we have some assets that are in need of probate. They're stuck. Judge, we need you to give me the authority to sign a deed to transfer Katie's house to her heirs, or to sell it and give the money to her heirs, okay? So that's all it is. So when we talk about estate planning, we talk about trusts specifically, the reason people do trusts, the biggest reason people do trusts, is to avoid probate. And the way that we avoid probate is that we deed our houses and our other titled assets out of our names and into our trust's names. So usually when I do a trust for somebody, I do deeds that very same day. We have you sign a deed that says, I, Katie, am deeding the property to me, Katie, trustee of the Katie Trust. So it's still me, but now I'm acting as manager or trustee of my own trust, which can never die. So there you go. So now they're never stuck. So now the recorder's office has a piece of real estate that's owned by an entity which can never die, so that when I die, I'm simply dying as manager or trustee of my trust. But my trust inside of it tells everyone what happens after I die. When I die, I'm making Alicia my trustee, okay? So now she just has to show up, and she has to present my death certificate along with the trust, prove that I'm deceased, prove her identity, and now she's got authority. We don't have to go to a judge for authority. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, yeah, you had a question. Yeah.
You sort of just answered, but one is you need a trust if you're under the threshold.
Okay.
What are the disadvantages of probate? Because there's some disadvantages to a trust. You've got to pay you a bunch of money to make one.
Mm-hmm.
How much pain is probate?
Yeah. So the answer to how big of a deal is probate completely depends on your situation. So the reason why all the movies and the books and the things about probate are so interesting and thrilling is because those usually involve families who want to fight with each other, right? And the shenanigans ensue. And so probate becomes an opportunity for people to come into court and say, well, Dad called me on the phone 3 weeks ago and told me that I was supposed to get everything, and I can prove it. Here are my phone records, right? And now we're when we talk about whether probate is a big deal or not, first of all, you want to look at your family situation. You want to just make sure, my kids get along great. They're going to cooperate and fully take care of this. Not a big deal. Sure, probate becomes less of a big deal. If you're leaving things to your children who don't have the greatest relationship or have had big fights in the past and really kind of hate each other's guts or whatever the situation is, maybe it's a bigger deal. If you're leaving your stuff to a bunch of unrelated entities, like other family members who maybe don't have much to do with each other, that may or may not be a bigger deal. Probate will just, in the best case scenario, probate will just cost your estate a little bit extra money. So in general, to your point about the cost of the trust, probate will cost more than setting up a trust will. But I have clients tell me all the time, listen, that's their problem. I'm off to my next great adventure. I've passed away. They can deal with probate. They can use their shares to pay for probate. I want to keep my money right now to use for myself. Fantastic. That's the best thing about estate planning. You get to make your plan what you want it to be. So it's going to, it will cost money, especially if they hire an attorney. Attorney's going to do the probate. They can do the probate themselves. Depending on how sophisticated they are, that's going to go well or less well. And then it's just going to kind of build in kind of a 6 to 12 month pad between when they can actually get access to their assets. So it just delays things a little bit. May or may not be a big deal, right? So it's just kind of you're thinking about what you want to have happen. I want to make this as easy and seamless for people, and I own real estate and things that are going to be stuck. Maybe a trust becomes more attractive. If you're not as concerned about that, a will do exactly what a trust does. It just will not be able to own the assets, which is why probate becomes necessary. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah.
I've heard of something called a beneficiary deed, which would allow you to specify real estate property to go to your family members, and if they don't make that, which is it automatically transferred. Is that something
sure.
that you can do? And
yeah. Yeah, so the question is about, you mentioned a beneficiary deed. So if you guys want to look into this, it's called a transfer on death deed, TOD deed, transfer on death deed. And this is a deed that's very state specific, okay? Utah didn't have this such a deed until like 7 or 8 years ago. It's fairly new. Don't quote me on the time range, but it wasn't an option when I first became an attorney 15 years ago, and then it became an option. I think it's a good option. It's a little bit of, you have to be kind of very certain about what you're doing, because you don't really, so just backing up, I'll explain. So you can fill out a deed in Utah and Arizona and some other states in the nation where you actually record a deed with the recorder's office on your property that says, when I die, this property is going to be transferred to this person or people, okay? So that becomes a pretty concrete step, right? Whereas a will or a trust, you can have, and it's going to accomplish that. All the trustee needs to do is execute a new deed after you've passed. So you can see in a deed or a will or a trust, if you change your mind, if someone dies, if we have some weird issue going on with somebody, so-and-so now has a raging drug problem, a will or a trust is really easy to amend, okay? So you can go in and change your mind. The deed becomes a bit more of a concrete step because now you've recorded it. That's the law now. So in order to undo it, you're going to have to go and, revoke it. So now you're going to have a title that's going to show publicly what you're doing. So that's the other thing that people sometimes don't like is the deeds become really public, whereas the will and the trust are very private. So if you're like, I'm going to do a transfer on death deed to my child, And then I change my mind. So now my title shows transfer on death deed, now a revocation, and now a new transfer on death deed to Cousin Jeffrey, revocation, right? So now everyone can follow along with your private decision-making. So it's just a matter of pros and cons. The transfer on death deed works really well when you have one heir and you're pretty solid that that person is going to always be your one heir. After that, we start to build in, people just have complicated lives. Like, you know, if your child has passed away and you don't want your daughter-in-law to now inherit your house, you're going to have to publicly kind of revoke that. So it just kind of, it's just kind of up to you on how you want to do that. But that is an option. I've done several of those for people. I've traditionally seen those work really well when someone's at end of life and we kind of know, you know, so-and-so is going to pass away in the next 6 to 8 months or something, right? That's a pretty good time to do some really last minute like transfers to avoid a probate, specifically if you don't have a trust. If all I have is a will and I want to avoid a probate with my house, transfer on death deed, a great choice, right? So I like it as a tool. It's just, does it fit the circumstance? That makes sense. It's a great question. Yes. So vehicles. So to just think anything that's titled with an institution, that includes vehicles and bank accounts, unfortunately. We all pretty much have bank accounts. So then the question with bank accounts and vehicles become, how valuable are they? Because in Utah, it's technically a probate, but it's called the small estate affidavit. If the item is worth less than $100,000, we can usually get away with just doing some simple small estate affidavits and moving those out. Vehicle titles are especially easy to kind of finagle around because the DMV is just looking for the signature on the back of the title. They're not verifying your death like with the obituaries, right? So like your family's going to be able to work that out pretty easily. The bank accounts can become an issue, specifically if you've got maybe an IRA or some larger retirement account that has a bunch of money in there that you're living on, and then you pass away, and it's over $100,000, and now we do have a need for an actual probate. So if you have beneficiaries, so the beneficiaries will inherit immediately. It just becomes another thing that you have to kind of keep track of. So I'll just talk to you about, you can arrange your estate in a million different iterations. When I talk about the estate planning stuff, I always tell people you can kind of do what you want. The best practice and the one that's going to be easiest for you to keep track of through your life is that everything is pointed to the trust. So your trust is like your commanding document for everything. And so the way we point things to our trust is we actually redo the, after we do our trust, we redo our beneficiary designation form to name our trust as the beneficiary. Because what you're doing there is you're making sure that the person you've appointed as trustee is now the person that is the only one, so we don't have 17 people contacting all these companies. You just have the one person you trust that has the authority to contact everything, get everything organized, then write everyone their checks, right? So you can leave your kids or Cousin Jeffrey as the beneficiary on those IRAs, but you may not want to because you might forget or just lose track of it, right? I probably should go review my beneficiary forms because I'm not certain that I put my trust in there as the beneficiary. It just becomes one of those steps that we never think about and that can easily get lost, and then all of a sudden, oh crap, my ex-wife that I divorced 10 years ago is still the heir to my IRA. I've had that happen with clients before. So it is what it is. They're, you know, because they do inherit as soon as you die, those beneficiaries are the only ones who can submit a claim on those. So, yeah, good question. Any other questions? Yeah, so joint bank accounts are interesting and the cause of a lot of problems. I'll tell you why. So joint bank accounts work really well for spouses. Okay, so when you have a joint bank account, what the law says is that when one person dies, the other joint account owner becomes the sole legal owner. So you can see how that works really well for spouses, makes it a lot easier transition financially when a spouse dies. You can see how that becomes an absolute nightmare if you put your child on there with you. So this is what happens a lot. If you're trying to do some planning without doing the trust, and you're like, okay, I've got three kids, I'm just going to put my oldest son on all my accounts with me, then I'm just going to tell him, share with your brothers, you know, just, this is going to be easy, you can go to the bank, get this out, share with your brothers. A lot of times they don't share after you die. I'm just sorry to tell you that. That's what I deal with a lot is they you know, so what happens is legally, I'm actually dealing with a case right now where this occurred. Mom passed away, had put oldest son on her account she wasn't really wealthy, you know, but most of her money was in her checking account. And that son is not sharing with the other two, and he doesn't have to by law. Right? He should do it to be a good son, right? And be honorable, but he's not. And he doesn't have to by law. Okay? So in order to make a legal declaration of what you want to have happen to your accounts, it would have been better in that case for mom just to have the will, or even better, have a trust that owned the account that had instructions for all the kids to share. Because you're relying on the relationships that your heirs have with each other, and you're really trusting that person, and we all hope we can do that. And sometimes it does happen, right? But I get to see all the bad, you know, cases where that doesn't happen enough to just kind of nudge you to be like, okay, spouses, yes, absolutely, joint accounts are great. After that, really consider who you're putting on as a joint, because that person becomes the owner after you die. And in fact, they're a 50% owner while they're alive, which means if they're having a creditor chase them, your account could get pulled in there. We've had circumstances where mom's account's getting garnished because son had a child support garnishment, you know, and that son's account, when they do the financial, you know, the reports to see where his accounts are. So you're kind of tying your assets in with your heirs. May or may not be a great idea. But again, you can organize things however you want. But sometimes it works great. Sometimes it doesn't. So, good question. Yeah. Problems and pitfalls. So what the question was, what are the problems and pitfalls of the do-it-yourself online stuff? So the only thing I can say about that is you're just not working with an advisor that can kind of tell you for your situation, you should do this and this doesn't work great for your, you know. Those forms can be very valid. Like I said, I mean, in Utah, you can have a will that you write on a napkin at Chili's, and that is called a holographic will. Under the law, and that becomes a valid will. So you're going to be able to create valid documents. I've been involved in some cases where the documents just kind of made things a little bit confusing for that family, or maybe the person thought they were doing something, but because they were doing it themselves, they didn't exactly get it right. The problem becomes you could buy one of those online forms and do a 100% perfect will and trust. But the problem is there's this large spectrum of gray area that you could fall into, and you're just taking that risk. If you go meet with an attorney, you know, then at least that person is going to be able to make sure that you're, you know, hitting all the things you need to hit. But other than that, it just depends on the form. You know, you just have to always watch out for kind of the scammy kind of places that didn't have an attorney draft their forms or something, and they just want you to pay them the $99 and, you know, here's some weird document and good luck to you. So just be cautious. I mean, I'd probably, if you're going to go that route, maybe skew towards the ones that you've heard the names a lot on the radio. They've been, you know, just kind of shows you they've been a lot around for a long time and they're still out there. LegalZoom, right? That's a name we hear a lot. You know, go for it, you know. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just kind of your preference. Yeah. Good question. So the question is estate planning stuff, does it have to be recorded or filed somewhere? So specifically out west, we treat our documents as private. That's kind of a like wild, wild west, like government stay away, right? Back east, there's actually some states that have what are called will registers. So if you guys are from back east, you might, I think Connecticut, some of those old 13 colony states, they used to record wills and on a register with the court, so you could actually go and like search the will register. When the Wild Wild West was settled, people stopped wanting the government to be so involved in their private documents, so we don't really have that. You're always going to record deeds, right, you know, with the recorder's office. So, but everything else is not. The healthcare directive, I tell people, you can fill this out and put it in your safe deposit box and nobody sees it. I really highly dissuade you from doing that by saying take it to your doctor's office at the very least. Have it on file with all your doctors. And if you want to go one extra step, take it to, I think we have, you know, the two big hospitals now, but specifically take it over to IHC, because in the worst case scenario where we're in a car accident, unexpected, we get taken to the hospital in an ambulance, we're unconscious. They pull our ID out of our wallets or our purses and they put you in the system. We want a little heart button they have on the IHC system, a little heart that pops up that says, this person's done their directive. And the doctor says, yay, we know who to call because otherwise, the social workers have to search high and low for who to call for you. So that directive, you've got your agent's name and phone number. So I would encourage you to go to the records department at the hospital, take a directive over there. They'll scan it in. If your doctor is part of the IHC network, you can simply take it to your next doctor's appointment, and that's going to be in their computer system at the hospital as well. So you kind of just want to look at where your doctors are. If you're going to holistic doctors who aren't in a network, might be a good step to take this to the hospital, just in case we have an ambulance situation, right? Because then the doctors know from reading who your agents are, who to call, and then if there's a real big emergency, they can say, this person didn't want life support, we're not doing it, you know? They'll do initial life support to stabilize you in an accident situation. That's just kind of unavoidable. But if they can't find anyone for you and you're lingering on life support, if you've filled out the form, they'll follow your wishes, right? So anyway, good question. So you kind of want to leave breadcrumbs to your information somehow. Best way is to record with your doctor's office and then just giving your family members like notice, hey, you're my agent. Here's a copy of my form. That's really helpful too, because when they hear that you've been in an accident, they can be like, oh, I'm, you know, Uncle So-and-so's decision maker. I need to call the hospital. So we do the best we can to plan for that sort of thing. Yeah. For them, you're asking if you can change. Sure. So the question is, if you've got somebody, a family member that's up there in age and their end-of-life decision-making is maybe changed, that kind of goes to your question back there, which is that person, we can only fill out our own directives. If you wanted to make decisions for someone else, you have to become their guardian. So if your loved one has the capacity to do a new directive, then they can simply do a new directive and choose whatever option they wish. If they're past the point of being able to understand a form and fill it out and sign it and all that stuff, then you might be in a situation where you need to become a guardian, if you're really concerned about being able to make that decision for them. So does that make sense? Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah.
Is it true that, say, this, you call 911 in a dire emergency, and you know this person has a DNR, I'm told they have to, they can't act on.
Like coming to the house?
They have to actually try to resuscitate.
Yeah, that's true. So the paramedics are going to attempt resuscitation. So if you call them to the house, they will attempt resuscitation to stabilize you to take you to the hospital. It's kind of that in between. It's once you're in the hospital under a doctor's care that end-of-life decision on the healthcare directive becomes controlling. There is a form called the POLST. It's a different form. It's called the POLST, Physician-Ordered Life Support something. Physician-ordered life support treatment form or something like that. Forget what the POLST stands for. But that's a form that your doctor fills out. That becomes a little bit more controlling. So the problem is with paramedics, they're not going to take the time to look through your files for the POLST. They're also not going to take the chance and do all the groundwork of like, hey, is this the person that filled out the POLST and is it valid? So the paramedics are really, you know, if you're calling them, they're going to assume that, hey, we're trying to intervene and save this person, you know. So you don't want to call paramedics if you're concerned about them doing CPR, is how I'll put that, you know. So that makes sense. The POLST, you'll see, like, if you go visit somebody that's in the hospital, or maybe even you yourself have been through some really life-threatening surgery or something where they were like, you know, you have a good chance of passing away. We're going to do a POLST so we understand if you get in an end-of-life situation, we know what you want. The doctor will fill out a POLST with you. But if you go visit someone with a terminal illness at the hospital, they'll have the POLST on the wall by their bed or pretty near their bed so that the hospital workers know, don't use the defibrillator, don't do CPR, apply comfort measures only, right, that sort of thing. So, yeah. Well, I think I'm out of time. If anyone has any other questions, I'm happy to stick around afterwards and talk. So, yeah, so I did bring cards. I have cards up here if you're interested and you want to chat with me about anything. I'm happy to do it. But other than that, thanks for having me today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah.